call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. There is a quorum present. And members, today we have several bills on the agenda. As a reminder to the public, the only public testimony we'll be taking on the bills are from individuals who signed up in advance per the agenda posting on the committee webpage. I am so sorry for my voice. I'm actually feeling a lot better, but I sound terrible. I have a bill on the floor tonight, so that's going to be interesting. All right. The first order of business is to approve last meeting's minutes. Do we have a motion? Representative Curran.
So moved, Chair.
Yeah, Representative Curran moves the minutes for March 15th, 2023. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for March 15th, 2023 are approved. First bill we're hearing today is House File 1278. This is a Representative Pawlowski bill. Welcome to the committee, Representative Pawlowski. I will move that House File 1278 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. There are no amendments filed on your bill, so please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House File 1278 comes to us as a result of the creation of Chapter 12B. Chapter 12B was created as a result of the legislative auditor review of Chapter 12A, and Chapter 12A was created as a result of the largest disaster in the history of this state, which happened in 2007 in southeastern Minnesota, when 18 inches of rain fell in one night, and most of southeastern Minnesota was inundated with water. Rushford was underwater. We lost roads, bridges, and somewhere down in New Orleans is a lot of our infrastructure. I think it all floated away. These bills were created, or these chapters of law were created, so that we would have a plan when a disaster struck. 12A says if it's a presidential declaration, immediately protocols go into place. 12B, because not everything rises to a presidential level of a disaster, allows for a gubernatorial declaration of a disaster. And then funds can immediately be sent to those areas stricken. And when we say stricken, if you've had a disaster in your area, you know that immediately we need to remove all sorts of damaged equipment, waste. We need to restore water, electricity. We need to do a number of things. And this account is down to we're down to $700,000. Usually in the spring, we'll have at least $2 to $3 million of damage. It's likely this year we will have much more. So the $40 million that you see here, hopefully, will get us through this year and next year. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to the department.
Thank you. Kevin Reed is here from the department. If you could introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Kevin Reed. I'm the interim director for the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, and we're here in support of this bill. What it allows us to do, on average, we spend about $20 million per year in disaster reimbursement costs to local communities. And this will allow us to refill that account and be ready for the next 2 years and potentially looking at the spring. If we needed to have it right away, it would be available to us. So we're in support of this. All of this, or about 92% of this account, goes to Greater Minnesota in helping them recover from disasters. Thank you.
Thank you. And we did not have anybody from the public sign up to testify, so we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Pawlowski, just a brief question. In the governor's budget, this actually is in there, but it takes money from fiscal year 24. Why are we doing this in fiscal year 23?
Madam Chair, Representative Mueller, we're doing it because the account now is down to $700,000. We will anticipate at least $2 to $3 million in a normal spring. This is likely not to be a normal spring. So we need to replenish the account. I want to remind members, too, that when we are not in session, this account can be activated. And for those of you who have never been in a special session, there is nothing special about a special session. And one of the reasons why this was created was because of the problem with having a special session in 2007. So this is an important piece of legislation, particularly for any area of the state that gets hit this season by any type of flooding or any other type of disaster.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Representative Pawlowski. I agree. Living in southern Minnesota myself, I understand just how devastating. We had a really bad rainfall in 2004 as well, and was moving into my new house, tearing up carpet. So that was exciting during that time, especially when we have such a great surplus. This is a fantastic use of that money. And knowing that it's going to be such a horrible spring, I'm really excited that we're getting this bill passed today. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. Thank you, Representative Pulaski. I don't have a question so much as a comment, because yesterday was Insurance Day on the Hill, and I met with some insurance professionals who outlined to me that the number of storms and natural disasters that we are having have increased significantly over the past 10 years, and this is costing Minnesotans a ton of money, and as Representative Mueller just pointed out, directly impacts their lives. So I am in tremendous support of this bill. I think it's a good use of money and a good use of protecting Minnesotans when they need it most. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Hollins, when this was created in 2014, it was the result of a legislative auditor review of Chapter 12A. And that was the basic reason to create Chapter 12B, because the disasters were coming at us so fast, and they weren't all presidential declarations. But there is no local unit of government that can sustain repairing these disasters. We have to be there to help.
Any further member discussion? Seeing none, any further closing comments, Representative Pulaski?
Madam Chair, no, I know you have a packed agenda, and let's just move on.
All right. I renew my motion that House File 1278 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. The motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
All right, members, next we have House File 2023. It's a Representative Long bill. And I will move that House File 2023 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And we also have the A6 amendment. I will move the A6 amendment. Representative Long, please tell us about the A6.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. So one of the primary requests I've had from the public as we've been moving this bill through is to expand the list of petition-based expungements, not automatic. So this would expand by three the number of petition-based expungements that are eligible, including third and fourth degree drug possession and third degree burglary. So this would be not a burglary of a dwelling, but an example is stealing a bike from a garage for third degree burglary. So this would still have to go through a court process and would be petition based.
Any discussion to the A6 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the A6 amendment is adopted. We also have the A7 amendment. I will move the A7 amendment. Representative Long to the A7.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. This is a technical amendment to clean up some language that agencies had flagged for us.
Any discussion to the A7 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A7 amendment is adopted. Next, we have the A8 amendment, and that is the Chair Becker-Finn amendment to the A8. Chair Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. The A8 is the result of a conversation in Judiciary Committee, which was the first stop for this bill. Representative Scott pointed out a couple other crimes that we would want to have included as excluded under the bill, and just appreciate the work with Representative Scott to get this done. And also, since I have the floor, I did bring coffee for your publics, or your judiciary comrades did not drink as much of it, so you benefit.
Thank you. Representative Long to the A8.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. I appreciate Chair Becker-Finn bringing this amendment and would urge members to support. Lead Scott had pointed out that there were crimes that we were excluding for misdemeanors but not for felonies, and that was an inconsistency, so we're going to exclude those for the felony level as well.
Any discussion to the A8? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the A8 amendment is adopted. Okay, I think that's it for the amendments, so please go ahead and tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. The Clean Slate Act has a simple premise, which is that we should give those who have paid their debt to society an opportunity for redemption. Too often, having a criminal record severely limits an individual's opportunity to find jobs, housing, or education. I've heard from many constituents who are trying very hard to turn their lives around but are struggling to get back on their feet with finding housing or finding educational opportunities. One in four Minnesotans have some type of criminal record, and 90% of employers conduct background checks. So when you add that up, that's a really significant barrier to finding employment for tens of thousands of Minnesotans. Our current system of opt-in expungement by petition isn't cutting it. Too many don't know they're eligible or don't take advantage. There are barriers to pursuing expungement by petition in terms of time and legal costs, and that has resulted in the uptake rate of expungement in Minnesota of just 5% of those who are eligible for expungement. This bill is similar to broad bipartisan efforts we've seen enacted now in 10 states, including Utah, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Oklahoma. In several of these states, it's passed unanimously or with very little opposition. In Michigan, those who have had records expunged saw their average wages increase by 25%. We're facing a real workforce crunch in our state, and giving employers the peace of mind that these crimes no longer need to be part of a background screening would help them hire and would expand their worker pool. This bill also builds on the leadership that many of our county attorneys are currently showing in expunging old records. Prosecutors have initiated expungements for old misdemeanors, particularly in some of our metro counties, but not all counties in the state have the same resources to pursue this, so there have been regional inequities in who is being able to get prosecutor-initiated expungements. And the County Attorneys Association has been a really terrific partner in this effort, with many county attorneys putting many hours in to put this bill together. So the Clean Slate Act would automatically expunge records for certain crimes after a crime-free waiting period. It excludes enhanceable offenses, person offenses, or criminal sexual conduct, as well as the two we just added in the A8 today. It contains important protections, including allowing continued law enforcement access to records and allowing Department of Human Services access to records for sensitive employment background checks. This year, we also added that pardons will be automatically expunged. This is the third biennium that I brought up this proposal, and I'm grateful for the bipartisan support it's received in the past. We've also had really strong organizational support, including from victims organizations like Violence Free Minnesota and Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, the Catholic Conference, and groups on the right and the left, from Americans for Prosperity to the ACLU. So this bill is an opportunity for rehabilitation, for better economic opportunities, which we know reduces recidivism. It's about offering hope and offering second chances. And Chair Mueller, I have four individuals I'm hoping we can speak briefly to the committee.
Thank you. Your first testifier is Amber Yokeem. If you can come on down to the testifier table. And then on deck, we have Chaz Anderson. So if I call you on deck, if you can work your way towards the table, we'd appreciate it. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Amber Yokeem. Thank you so much for this opportunity to speak on an issue that is very important to me. I spent 14 years of my life addicted to meth. Throughout that time, I wound up in situations with people that I would have never thought I would surround myself with. Abusive relationships, addiction, and criminal behavior became my life. My crimes ranged from drug charges to financial card fraud, check forgeries, and false information to the police. Because of the decisions that I made, I wound up in prison, I believe, in 2002. One would think after prison, it would shock a person straight, but for me, it did not. Nothing changed because I didn't change while I was there. I kept my connection to the outside world through people that I once considered friends, and when I was released, I was back to the same thing, using drugs. After being arrested numerous times, I found myself in front of a judge once again, but this time something was different. I had exhausted all of my resources and burned bridge after bridge and couldn't break free from the lifestyle or my substance use. I was tired and ready to embrace change. It was in 2009 when that judge allowed me to enter Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge. It was there in that program where I found my freedom. This past January, I celebrated 14 years of freedom from that lifestyle and using meth. It has taken a while to recover from the trauma, the lifestyle, the bad decisions, and everything else that you could imagine, but I know for certain I will never go back to that lifestyle or drugs. In 2018, I received an early pardon extraordinary. Let me tell you, it was a very emotional day, one that I will forever be grateful for. However, I soon found out that a pardon would not automatically clear my record. On paper, I would still look like a criminal to future landlords and employers that do not understand the law, which could hinder future housing and employment. I have been working to get each case expunged, which can be challenging for an individual that doesn't understand the process. I know that I'm not the only one that has encountered barriers such as these. There is so much untapped talent and people that deserve a second chance if given the opportunity. I am so fortunate that I am where I am in life, have worked at the same organization for the past 12 years, and that someone took a chance and believed in me. I think back and cannot believe that was once my life. Thank you for your time and for considering the Clean Slate Act.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing your story with us. Next up, we have Chaz Anderson and on deck, Grace Waltz. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chaz Anderson, and I'm here representing the Justice Action Network. The Justice Action Network is the nation's largest bipartisan criminal justice organization, and the organization has been active here in Minnesota since 2016. Since the fall of 2019, a group of stakeholders have been working on legislation regarding automatic expungement. On the handout in your packets, you'll find a list of stakeholders who have been working on this issue for several years. During this time, 10 states have enacted automatic expungement laws, with Pennsylvania and Utah being the first states in 2018 and 2019. This has given us the opportunity to learn from early adoption states, and the legislation before you represents the work of the stakeholders here in Minnesota and also lessons we've learned in other states. I'll point to a couple of studies that show petition-based expungement systems fail to provide the relief they had intended. A 2019 study from the University of Michigan found that just 6.5% of eligible people in Michigan obtained expungement within 5 years of eligibility. Another study from researchers at Santa Clara University, and this study looked at actually Minnesota's petition-based expungement system, found that just 5% of eligible Minnesotans obtained expungements through the system. As Majority Leader Long mentioned, there's an economic case for moving forward with a limited automatic expungement process as proposed in House File 2023. The same studies I referenced from the University of Michigan and Santa Clara University found that individuals who obtained expungements experienced real wage increases post-expungement. In the Santa Clara University study on Minnesota's petition-based expungement system, on average, an individual's annual wage increased equaled $5,100 per year. That equates to an estimated $2.4 billion in cumulative wages lost every year in Minnesota due to convictions that could be but have not been expunged. This bill also provides important employer and public safety protections. House File 2023 extends protections under Minnesota Statute 181.981 for Minnesota employers. Additional public safety protections include courts, prosecutors, and law enforcement agencies will have access to the expunged data. Expunged records, record of convictions will be disclosed for the purposes of a background study for DHS. The BCA is required to notify each arresting and citing law enforcement agency that expungement relief was granted. And in any subsequent prosecution of a person granted expungement relief, the expunged record has the same effect as if the relief was never granted. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time today and for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 2023.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Grace Walt, and on deck, we have Bob Small. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Long, and members. My name is Grace Waltz, and I'm the Vice President of Public Policy at the Minneapolis Regional Chamber, and I'm here to testify in support of House File 2023, the Clean Slate Act. As the largest local chamber of commerce in the state, representing businesses across the Twin Cities region, we know the importance of having trained and skilled workers. As we continue to grapple with an extraordinarily tight labor market, that need is more important than ever. We believe this legislation will help provide a pathway for workers to help fill this void. Unfortunately, there are many obstacles for individuals with criminal records who seek to better their lives but face barriers in education, housing, and employment. According to the Brennan Center, the number of Americans with a criminal history has increased significantly over the past 30 years. Today, nearly one-third of working adults have a criminal record. Our country has roughly the same number of people with criminal records as they do with college degrees. These numbers do not include people who are arrested but never charged or individuals who were acquitted. As we look to our workforce in the next decade, employers need trained and skilled workers. When we testified in support of this bill in previous legislative sessions, we spoke of the worker shortage that was bound to continue even in a post-pandemic world. The need for workers across all sectors and industries is still very real, and employers are looking for creative solutions. This legislation provides a much-needed opportunity to expand our talent pool. This bill will allow a pathway for individuals to receive automatic expungements for certain convictions while still maintaining public safety access to those records. We're also pleased that this bill includes important protections for employers. This will make an enormous difference for individuals who are seeking to enroll in post-secondary education options, training programs, obtain occupational licenses, and secure stable housing. Thank you for the opportunity to provide our support for this important legislation.
Thank you. And next we have Bob Small. Welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robert Small. I am the Executive Director for the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. First, I'd like to thank Representative Long. He mentioned that we've been working on this for a long time, and we continue to work on it, and thank you, thank him for his persistence and his endurance. I am here to be a proud supporter with the many others that Ms. Anderson had referred to in supporting this bill, and the County Attorneys Association urges the passage of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. We did not have anybody from the public sign up to testify, so we will move on to member discussion. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I just want to thank Majority Leader Long and Chair Becker Finn for working with Lead Scott on amending that language to make sure that we're get the bill in the order that's intended. And I also just really appreciate you bringing this bill. I've told this story before, but it bears repeating. Working as a manager for a small business that had a change in ownership a couple of years ago, I had somebody working with me in a subordinate managerial role who was just an absolute rock star. I mean, he was great for our organization. But because there was a change in ownership, we had to do onboarding for everyone all over again. And lo and behold, they discover something in his background. And we ended up losing him. And that was a major impact to the operation and to the morale. Because what are we going to do now? And it's worth noting, and I'm sure this is probably indicative of a lot of cases, that he was doing it right. Right? He had reformed. He had gotten over it and moved on. And that's something that is important. And so I'm glad we're addressing that with this bill. I do have one question. And that is, I assume that in the event that somebody reoffends, the records will be available to use in consideration for any subsequent criminal trials. Is that correct?
Representative Long.
Chair Mueller, Representative Hudson, first, thanks for sharing that story. I think that's a perfect illustration of why this bill is needed. And I think you heard directly from the chamber and employers about oftentimes the employers feel like they have to take it into consideration. Even if they have an employee they want to hire, they feel like they might be subject to legal liability or public scrutiny if they hire somebody. And so this is a good way to say the state has considered this set of low-level crimes after a certain waiting period to not be relevant for employment. So you can hire these individuals and feel good about it. And in direct answer to your question, yes, courts and prosecutors will have access to this data in perpetuity. So it could be used in future court proceedings.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Long. The other question I had was just procedural involving the path of the bill. So according to the fiscal note, there's going to be costs related to human services and the trunk highway fund. It's my understanding that the motion is for this to go to Ways and Means. Is that correct, Chair Mueller?
That's correct.
Would it be appropriate to refer the bill to human services and transportation?
I would like to defer to Representative Long to answer that. We did just get the fiscal note recently, so Representative Long.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. So the bill path this session has been the same as it's been the last two times, which has been Judiciary and Public Safety. The Trunk Highway Fund is part of the Public Safety Department, which is in the jurisdiction of this committee. It deals with the State Patrol. And then for the Human Services Department, we're not making substantive changes to their procedures. This is just additional costs that they'll be incurring because of the additional reviews they're doing. But I don't believe this would be something they would carry in their budget area. I think this would be carried either in the public safety or as the Ways and Means Chair would see fit, but not likely a Human Services line item.
Representative Hudson.
I will defer to your institutional knowledge. Thank you.
Further member discussion? Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. It's our impression that the Trunk Highway Fund is in transportation, not public safety. Is that where we're at?
I'm sorry, I couldn't understand your question.
I said it's our understanding that Trunk Highway is under transportation, not public safety. Is am I getting that wrong?
That's my my understanding as well.
So we're sending this to, that doesn't need to go back to transportation, or it is?
Yeah, Representative Long.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Novotny. So the bill has not gone to transportation in the past. I think the substantive jurisdiction is within this committee, which is that we're dealing with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and their review of records. I think that the Trunk Highway has to deal with the sealing of records for the State Patrol. So I don't think this needs to go to transportation.
Representative Novotny.
Okay, well, just confused because it's got the fiscal note that addresses that. If it's under the State Patrol, that would be Trunk Highway and it would be transportation. Thank you, Chair Mueller. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think what we're going to do, especially because we just got the fiscal note, I'm going to change the motion to lay this bill over, and then we can have a chance to look at this and bring it back up.
Thank you, Chair.
All right. Any further member discussion? All right. Closing comments, Representative Long.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. I appreciate the committee's consideration and hope that we can get this done. I think this has been an effort of many years and much collaboration, and I think it would be a good opportunity for our state. I think Representative Hudson illustrated perfectly what this bill will do to help get people back to work.
All right. So then I will renew my motion and lay over House File 2023 as amended. Next, members, we have a budget presentation from the Department of Public Safety. All right. Welcome back to the committee, Commissioner Jacobson. Whenever you're settled in, you can introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
And good morning, Chair Mueller, members of the committee. Good to see you again. It's been a few hours anyway. Again, for the record, my name is Bob Jacobson. I am the Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety, and thanks for having us here today for this budget presentation. Just know I'll make the first few comments and the first few slides, and then we'll hand it off to our division directors to discuss the items in the PowerPoint and their budgets as we move on. First slide is about Commissioner's office. We are hope to continue to maintain our current service levels. We have over 2,000 employees, as you know, 10 divisions, asking for additional funding to maintain those current staffing needs. In our DPS administration area, we are short on staffing. We need to increase our capacity to serve all Minnesota communities safely, as you can see, and continue to meet those growing needs. With community engagement, again, we need to add some staffing. Is becoming ever more important to continue to work with our communities across the state of Minnesota, and looking for additional funding to increase our community engagement. Next item is our request for body worn camera grants. Again, we think that that's important to our form of policing in the state of Minnesota. We want to give opportunities to all communities to be able to implement body camera worn programs. So asking for additional funding with that. Our first responder wellness office, excited about this opportunity. Again, serving in first responder roles continues to be and becoming very difficult. We want to make sure that we have the ability to serve our first responders well. I also have a firearm safety package that's going to require, among other items, criminal background checks, extreme risk protection orders. We're really proud of to fund a firearm safety campaign. We've been working diligently on that, so we hope to be able to continue on firearm safety. We're also looking to put on a DPS strategy and analytics team. Again, just an opportunity for us to be able to focus more on agency-wide data, generate reports, continue to study statewide issues, and that will give us the ability to share more information. And, of course, always key is to increase transparency. Soft body armor, to be able to move this funding from the public safety budget to from the transportation budget. We also want to expand that opportunity for firefighters and EMS, again, a sign of the times with our first responders. Expand the line of duty death, additional funding for that. We think it's important to expand to cover cancer-related diseases linked to firefighting and suicide that's linked to PTSD or a recent traumatic event. And again, we think that that is important as we move on. And I will hand that off next to Director Kate Weeks.
All right, welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Kate Weeks. I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Justice Programs here with the Department of Public Safety. The Office of Justice Programs' primary functions are we are one of the main grant funders in the state of Minnesota for a variety of grants ranging from crime victim services all the way over to community crime prevention and youth intervention and everything in between. We also have the Crime Victim Reparations Program, so if you're a victim of a violent crime, you have access to financial reimbursements for things that you might experience after that crime. We also have our Crime Victim Justice Unit, which is the Crime Victim Ombudsman's Office for the state of Minnesota. We house the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives Office. We provide training and education for criminal justice professionals throughout the state, and we also have a Statistical Analysis Center. This year, we are asking for additional funding for our crime victim prevention grants. During the last full competitive process, OJP received $6.5 million in requests for $2.5 million available. This is one of our more robust and broad crime victim prevention grant programs. Previous funding provided resources for pretrial programs, probation programs, youth services, truancy programs, elder abuse prevention, neighborhood watch, residential engagement, and community and faith-based projects. What this does is really look at what a community needs and what they believe is the best way to address crime in their communities. We are also asking for an ongoing investment to establish an Office of Missing and Murdered African American Women. A report was released in December 2022 after a robust work by the Missing and Murdered African American Women Task Force, which we had the honor to support during 2022. We are asking for additional resources to staff that office to look at systems change, curriculum development, education and outreach supporting victims and families impacted by violence against black women and girls throughout the state, and providing resources to community organizations supporting those impacted the most. We are also asking for an investment in the Office of Justice Programs. The reason why I went through everything that we do need some support in areas to ensure consistent reporting, research and evaluation, grant compliance and financial monitoring, processing reparations claims, working with crime victims, ensuring that communities throughout the state know and understand the resources that are available to them, how to access them, and to ensure that all of the grantees that receive state funds are successful. So this funding would go to funding a statistical analysis center, compliance and financial monitoring staff, community outreach and capacity building staff, and individuals to help us process reparations claims and calls that come into the Crime Victim Justice Unit. We are also seeking additional funds for our Youth Justice Office. This is the office that was established in 2021 by the legislature to really enhance the work that Minnesota is doing in the area of youth justice. We are asking for a data specialist to help us analyze all of the data needed from the criminal justice partners to see what impacts we're having and where those gaps and barriers are in supporting our youth. We're asking for an additional investment in youth intervention program funding. During our last competitive process, OJP received $12 million in requests for $6 million available. We are also asking for an investment in a statewide crossover dual status youth program. What this is, it's a mouthful, but it aligns child welfare, juvenile justice, and other youth serving leaders, practitioners, and stakeholders into a unified team to figure out what are the best resources and needs for kids who are involved in the child welfare system and the juvenile justice system in Minnesota. We are also asking for additional resources for disparities reduction and delinquency prevention funding. And we would like to start three new grant programs. The next three new grant programs were actually thought about, discussed, and put forward by youth that have been involved in the juvenile justice system through a program led by the Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee called Listen, Lean, and Learn. And what they're asking for is an additional resources for to create more funding available for programs serving youth who are suffering mental health challenges or chemical dependency challenges in the juvenile justice system. They're looking for additional resources in communities or residential facilities have closed. And so that looking at programs that support youth and families so youth do not have to travel across the state looking for resources and services. And also asking for a grant program to fund programs working on anti-gang reduction strategies. Like I touched earlier, we are the home of the Missing Murdered Indigenous Relatives Office, which is fully established. We have a director and three staff working diligently across the state on this issue. One of the things that we realized when we stood up the office and hired the director last year is the incredible need of families and victims who have been impacted. And so we are asking for one case coordinator, a review coordinator, and a victim specialist to better serve families and victims reaching out to the office. In addition, we'd like to establish an advisory group to help guide the continue guiding the work of the office, and we would like to have reimbursement for that. For those services. We are also asking to establish a new program in the Department of Office of Justice Programs called Minnesota Heals. What this is doing is providing a fund to support families impacted by officer-involved deaths, as well as investing in communities throughout the state to establish nonprofits and trainers. So after a large event happens, whether it be a natural disaster, a bridge falling, a shooting, that you have practitioners in that community that can bring the community together to start the healing process for the community as well. It's still me again. So the next slide is dedicated to crime victim services. One of the things that we hear not only from our grantees but our coalitions and others is the need for housing for crime victim services. We are looking to establish two new programs. One is called the DV Housing First program that really focuses on the emergency shelter needs of someone fleeing a dangerous situation. And that also would include mobile advocacy services, which we found was a huge need, particularly during the pandemic. Instead of waiting for victims to come to an established brick and mortar shelter, funding staff to go to those victims where they're at, and then also investing in domestic violence transitional housing. Traditional transitional housing programs do not have the services that are unique to crime victims and what they need. We are also asking for an increase in funding for those victims of crime that might not fall under the DV sexual assault umbrella. So this is additional funding for emergency funding through Cornerstone, and it can also be used for legal services that victims of crime may need. And finally, we are asking for $11 million to help fund a federal funding gap that all states are going to be experiencing over the next couple of years. We're asking for $11 million ongoing to fund the VOCA gap. That is the Violence Against Crime Act funding, which is the primary source of funding for crime victim services in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. I just want you to pause for a second, and we'll have member questions after every couple of testifiers. Just that's okay. Were you done?
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, and I have a question for you, Director Weeks.
Yes.
So for the VOCA funding gap, originally in the governor's budget, I think it was $8 million, but it's now known that it'll be more likely $11 million. Is that correct?
Chair members, that is correct. So every year we get a notice of what our VOCA award will be for that next year. In August, we learned that the $8 million gap was coming, so that's what was originally put in the governor's budget. But further communication shows that the gap is going to be even larger in the upcoming years.
Thank you. And do we have member questions on the presentation thus far? Lead Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. If I could go back to the Minnesota HEALS bill, you have $2.8 million and you're discussing covering burial costs for someone involved in an officer-involved shooting or an officer-involved death. Could you give them a little more details of what that means? I'm looking for specific information. Are there any guide, restrictions on who would be involved in this? If they die as a result of an attack on an officer or a suicide by cop, and we're still going to, would they still be eligible for this reimbursement?
Director Weeks.
Chair members, those are very good questions. The idea is one of the things that we saw with our crime victim reparations program is a family has experienced a death that they did not have anything to do with. And what we also saw, but they don't necessarily qualify for crime victim reparations where other victims would. And so we saw and we heard a need to figure out how to address those families and how to support those families. There was many requests coming into the agency on what could be done. And so this idea is to look at supporting those families who now have costs. And what we have also seen is those families are facing costs that are above and beyond what maybe a normal or traditional funeral would look like. That could do to the media attention, that can do to the number of people coming to those funerals, that could do to security concerns and additional costs related. So this program is really looking at what could we do to support them outside of the criminal or the crime victim justice program. So right now there are not restrictions on that. I think each case is unique. But those are something that the program administrators would need to work on.
Lead Nabani.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. I would really think we'd want to put some pretty strong guardrails on that. I'm flashing back to an individual who I can still give you his full name and date of birth from 30 years ago who was in dire financial straits and saw me happen to be driving along minding my own business, and he thought if he could hit me head on there would be a shootout and I might do something to kill him. When he pulled his wallet in a threatening manner trying to repeatedly make it appear like he was drawing a gun, and after the fight and I got him into custody, he told me the story that he hoped that at least his family could get something if he could get shot by a cop for no reason. The mindset is already out there, and now we're going to give them an immediate reimbursement for their burial rates. We're talking about somebody who's already in a mental distress, and now we're going to offer them an out. I would hope we would reconsider that, Chair, and we'll discuss language with that if you want to work with that. Thank you.
Did you want to respond, Director Weeks?
Chair members, we're always happy to work on language to address any concerns. The intent of this fund is not necessarily for that individual, but the family members who may or may not have had any interaction or been associated with what happened. And you're right, that is a fair question, but this focus is really on that family that's left behind with a lot of expenses that they didn't anticipate.
All right, I think we will move to the next presenter, who I believe is the Fire Marshal, Jim Smith. Welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Moeller, members of the committee. My name is Jim Smith, and I proudly and humbly serve as Minnesota State Fire Marshal. On the first slide, Am I supposed to advance this? Thank you. On the first slide, first heading, you'll see a request for firefighter training and education. The State Fire Marshal Division has recommended an appropriation of $1 million from the general fund in both 2024 and 2025. This increase would add to the very needed training reimbursement funds for the 750-plus fire departments or 20,000 firefighters across the state of Minnesota. The second item, State Fire Marshal Staff and Fire Surcharge. The State Fire Marshal Division has recommended an increase in its base budget of $2.5 million from the fire safety account in both 2024 and 2025. To accomplish this, we are also recommending the fire surcharge be increased by 0.15% back to its original 2006 figure of 0.65%. This is a separate bill which will be heard later on this morning. With this increased funding, the State Fire Marshal Division could, for the first time since 1998, increase its staffing to better manage and deliver on the ever-increasing demands on services by our divisions and our state response teams, which include the 11 hazardous material response teams, our 4 bomb squads, 2 urban search and rescue teams, and 1 air rescue training air rescue team. The last item on the list is the State Hazardous Response Team and Bomb Squad. The State Fire Marshal Division has recommended an increase in the base budget funding for our state emergency response teams totaling $1.5 million. This budget increase would come from both the general and the fire safety account in 2024 and 2025. The reason for the split in the account is because currently our bomb squads are historically, they are covered under or funded out of the general fund, and then the state teams, their base budget increase would come out of the fire safety account. The increased budget recommendation would assure the state emergency response teams have adequate funding for emergency and non-emergency responses and to assist in the purchase of essential and vital specialized equipment.
Thank you. And Commissioner, I believe you're, and if you can just stay there.
Sure.
And then Commissioner, I believe you're going to handle the alcohol and gambling enforcement slide.
That's correct.
That does not look like your photograph.
Yeah, it does not look like me. That's true. Bob Jacobson, Commissioner of Public Safety, sitting in for Director Sincotta. For alcohol gambling enforcement, as you know, we are responsible for completing criminal history background checks for various applicants, employees, licensees, and vendors, several places including the Minnesota Lottery, Gambling Control Board, and Minnesota Racing Commission. Those criminal history checks are necessary for those agencies to move forward with their hiring and licensing processes. We also support tribal gaming partners, 20 casino gaming facilities, and their respective criminal history background checks for key personnel pursuant to tribal state compacts. These are also necessary. We do about 6,000 to 9,000 criminal history checks annually. The reason we're asking for this funding is that a recent audit of our criminal justice information system determined that Alcohol and Gambling's current network server is non-compliant. In order to remedy this, a segregated server is needed.
All right, and so we'll open it up for member questions. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Fire Marshal Smith, just two real brief questions. One is, on the EMS training, is this EMR or EMT training?
Fire Marshal Smith.
Chair Mueller, Representative Hewitt, it could be either. It all depends on what the fire department requires of its members.
Okay. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and one last more statement or question just to have the topic here. As most of you know, I'm embedded with the EMS problem that we have in the state, but along that pathway I've also found a large problem with our firefighters' recruitment and retention. Do we have a plan, and are we working on it?
Fire Marshal Smith.
Chair Mueller, Representative Hewitt, that's a very good question. One of the components of increasing the staffing of the Fire Marshal Division is to include two dedicated FTEs specific to recruitment and retention. As you know, we've had discussions where we are also very interested in the EMSRB and how we can look at not only the fire side but the EMS side. And today's fire service, there's very little separation between fire and EMS. Most departments are running about 85% of their calls in the EMS world. So viewing that as being a very large time constraint, especially for greater Minnesota, the paid on call, whatever, we truly believe we need to address that issue, and we are hoping to put on two recruitment and retention personnel full time.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Fire Marshal Smith. I think that's a start, and we have to look at this as a major issue, so thank you.
Representative Woody.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Commissioner Jacobson, the increase, is that due to the possibility of legalized sports betting to kind of do some of the work there?
Commissioner.
Chair Mueller, Representative Woody, I do not know the answer to that. My understanding is that this is based on just needing a segregated server and because we were not compliant with CGIS. But if that's different, I will certainly get back to you and give you that information.
Any other questions now? All right, we can move on to the next presenter then, and I believe it is Director Kevin Reed. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. Kevin Reed, I'm the Interim Director for the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. And we really have three requests this morning. The first one you heard already from Representative Pawlowski, that's $40 million to replenish the disaster assistance account. I think he did a great job, so I won't belabor that one. The next is $300,000 ongoing to increase our school safety, to add two more. As we see more broad threats to our schools, we're getting more requests to help them in the prevention side, the preparedness side, and the recovery side. The response to that, those issues are locally, but we are there to round that out in the whole cycle of helping them. And so we're seeing a lot more requests, and adding two more to the five that we currently have would allow us to keep up in the school safety realm. And then another request of $500,000 ongoing for the increasing the changes in emergency management, so that we are statutorily required to do the training for emergency managers throughout the state, and we want to add trainers to help us do that, so we're not pulling our staff as subject matter experts out of their job to do the training, but actually put in some trainers to do that for all public, private, local, county, and state agencies. And then we also, because of the increased amount of grants, we need to add one more grant staff to make sure that we can be responsive and get that money out and be able to audit that as quickly as possible. So those are the three items that we have from emergency management.
All right, thank you. And we do have some questions for you, so we'll just keep you there for a minute. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Interim Director. Just a real brief question that I have a lot of concerns about, and I know that we have members on this committee that are concerned also as they put in bills for this. The school safety, I'm seeing a lot of people, even with, let's say, church safety, any place a large group is, a lot of opportunistic behavior going on with people coming in saying, this is the way to do it, this is the way to do it. Do we have our eye on that to make sure that we're our schools are not, these are teachers, right? These are not, they're not into that space. I think your division is. Are we protecting our schools so they're not making investments in things that are just, sounds good, looks good, but yet is it really going to get us where we need to go? Is there any kind of guardrails in this?
Interim Director.
Chair Mueller, Representative Hitt, yes. We, if you want to think about it, we come in as a sort of a consultant for school safety. We look at locally what they want. We also bring in best practices from the nation, and from what's happening here in Minnesota. We also see some of the technologies that are out there and try to advise them to make the best decision for that school. We understand that what would happen in maybe Rochester is going to be different than happens in Grigula, and we try to tailor our response to their specific needs and walk them through, what they think their threats are and what they think they need, and then understanding funding and other challenges that are there. So we do that quite often.
Representative Hewitt.
So what I'm hearing is that you're kind of specializing in this for a resource for our districts, so you can come in, and I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Oh, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hewitt. I just also wanted to mention that the Department of Public Safety has initiated meetings with our Department of Education just to make sure that we are working together, going across the large agencies in the state of Minnesota to make sure we're communicating and getting the word back out to school districts around the state of Minnesota, again, about our presence, about what we can offer for school safety around the state of Minnesota, and that we're here as a resource. So hoping to get the word out even more also, again, through our partners with the Department of Education.
Representative Egan.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And what currently guides best practices? I'm just curious as to if they're looking at federal documents or what agencies are suggesting, and then if you could kind of go into any developments that you think school districts should be allowed to look at, if it fits their models, if that's something that you guys are examining currently.
Interim Director.
Chair Mueller, representing it. When we look at best practices, it's from a variety of sources, after actions of events that have happened. It's working with the federal government on what they're seeing as threats, and trying to tailor that to the difference between a multi-building school, an individual school. So we're really trying to take real world events or potential and translate them for whatever that school district's concern is. That's sort of how we bring the best practices. We would have to talk more about suggestions. I think that's a very big, broader. I'd like to work with you on that option. I think that we'd have to involve Department of Ed, because they have a piece of this with us, and also some local perspective there. But I'm willing to work with you on that.
Representative Ingen.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Thank you very much.
All right. We can move on to the next presenter then. It's Director Dana Walberg. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dana Walberg, and I am the Director of the Emergency Communication Networks Division. We manage four core programs there, the statewide 911 program and the land mobile radio system known as ARMOR, which are programs under the state umbrella. And then in addition, two federal programs, wireless broadband in collaboration with FirstNet, the National Public Safety Broadband Network, as well as IPAWS, which is Integrated Public Alert and Warning. All four of those focusing on interoperable communications between and amongst both agencies and geographic jurisdictions. So we have two recommendations. One is modernization of the 911 statute to represent the next generation 911 environment that Minnesota has been transitioning to now for more than 10 years. And during that time, both the old network, the original network that was put in more than 40 years ago, has been coexisting as we've been segueing the new network in. And so we're now reaching a time where we're starting to decommission components incrementally for that old network. And within the next few years, we will have a complete replacement of a next generation 911 network environment. And so the network, or the statute changes, are merely designed to represent the new technology and network that is in place that has replaced all of the old network elements. In addition, we are recommending one-time funding in the amount of $7 million. This would come from the 911 special revenue account, and it would be distributed to eligible PSAPs using the same formula that they receive a monthly appropriation of 911 funds from us currently. It would be paid out in September 2023 and could be used through June of 2025, and this is specifically to help cover the costs of new equipment, technology upgrades, and training that is necessary for them to interface with the new network that is that the state is implementing as part of the transition to Next Generation 911. This is consistent not only with federal expectations for Next Generation 911 deployment, but also to meet the requests from the public who actually expect to be able to communicate with their smartphones with 911 in the same way that they do with one another. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Director. Do we have any questions for Director Wahlberg? All right, thank you. And next we have Superintendent Drew Evans. Welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Drew Evans, Superintendent at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I know you're short on time, so I will speak fast, but I'm happy to answer your questions now or into the future about these items. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension has several budget requests that the governor recommends funding in this particular year. The first one is a continuation of our Force Investigations Unit. This unit was originally funded in 2020 by you as the legislature to have an independent Force Investigations Unit that conducts use of force investigations involving our peace officers across the state of Minnesota. Required a unit to investigate allegations of criminal sexual conduct, allegations against our peace officers on or off duty, and instances of a Minnesota National Guard member that is accused of a sexual assault and a victim survivor that is also a Minnesota National Guard member. That funding sunsets at the end of this fiscal year, and without the ongoing funding for this unit, we would be unable to continue the work that this unit has been doing. The second item that the governor recommends funding is a violent crime reduction strategy. What this would be is three components, and we've had some similar conversations in other bills traveling through your committee: a forensics, analytics, and investigative support approach. The first would be doing additional front-end transitioning our civilian forensic scientists and technicians in our laboratory that would work to operate under what we were calling a first concept that would leverage investigative power, forensic intelligence, response, support, and testing. We'd utilize progressive forensic technologies combined with traditional forensic screening processes to prioritize and provide specialized services for violent crime investigations. This unit would expand on utilization of the National Integrated Ballistics Information Network, the rapid DNA program we have, crime scene response, and then integrate screening protocols to speed evidence through our laboratory. The second component of this would be additional civilian criminal intelligence analysts to identify criminal trends, identify those committing the most violent crimes across Minnesota, and assist investigations to take a very strategic approach to disrupting violent crime that we've experienced in our state. But we also think, and a couple of questions you've asked about school safety, is a more broad approach when it comes to our civilian criminal intelligence analysts. We've experienced significant threats to our schools across Minnesota. You've seen doxing attempts at our schools where we've called in bomb threats, school threats, and active shooter cases across Minnesota. This unit would work with those agencies across Minnesota to understand that. Also very concerned about threats of violence to our faith-based institution. By their very nature, they're intended to be open, but yet we've seen significant threats to our faith-based institutions, both in Minnesota and across the United States. They would also track and provide assistance in hate crimes and violence towards different groups, whether it be gender-based violence or LGBTQ plus communities, race or ethnicity, and these civilian criminal intelligence analysts will play critical roles in those cases. The last component of this would be our investigative support, and this would be a team that we would be utilizing, both made up of BCA agents and our local partners, to form a team that would work and has been working already in some respects to disrupt violent crime on a statewide basis. The BCA, due to some of the significant increases in violent crime and the staffing shortages that we've seen, has rededicated up to 14 agents and one analyst providing assistance to the Minneapolis Police Department, surrounding communities, Twin Cities metro-wide. We cannot sustain that active work that we've been doing, and they've had some success. We've seen crime go down. It's not at a level we'd want to see it, but we've seen that we've been able to do when we work in partnership with local, state, and federal authorities to focus very strategically on those committing the most crime in our communities. And so this team would be made up of both BCA agents and that under the umbrella of the BCA providing the direction and command of that team. The next item is the goal of a 30-day turnaround time. As part of that increase that we've seen in violent crime across Minnesota, we've experienced a significant increase in the number of cases coming into our laboratory. We saw annually about a 10 to 15% raise in demand in our testing that we've seen on a fairly normal basis. But beginning in 2020, we've seen about a 29-30% increase into our laboratory each year that's remained steady. This has created unacceptable lag times in our turnaround time. It's in particular for all types of DNA processing, but it's created significant lags in our violent crime processing as well, some cases taking many months to process. We believe that a target goal for our state and our community should be 30 days so that we provide answers to our investigations to move cases through the court system more quickly to make sure that we're meeting these goals, and this would be support by 2025. The next item is a funding of our FBI compliance and critical infrastructure and cybersecurity. This is twofold. One is it's completing a request that you've been funding pieces of over the years, and this would complete the cybersecurity that we've been looking for. We see this across all of government, but we maintain some of the most sensitive data in the state in our criminal history systems and our 30 different databases that we're looking going forward. This would upgrade critical infrastructure that we need to support those systems, and we've made significant improvements in our security funding and our security apparatus to protect that data. The second portion of this is really critical upgrades for data storage and backup system replacement to ensure, as you've seen cyber attacks, that we're able to recover data if we're ever to experience one, and then upgrade our e-charging system, which is one of our most used systems and frankly an envy of most of those across the United States, that most of our charging is done electronically. That system now is at the point where it needs to be upgraded and replaced to ensure that it is really meeting the needs of Minnesotans into the future. The next item is our Human Trafficking Response Task Force. The BCA operates and commands the Minnesota Human Trafficking Investigators Task Force. That task force relies currently on funding from the Office of Justice Programs focused on sex trafficking work specifically. That is the guidance of that particular work. The BCA doesn't receive any funding out of that. We provide resources, and then we fund our local partners to create that true statewide task force. The recommendation here would be to fund this and add additional resources to this out of state general fund to free up money out of the OJP grant program that really is intended to seed and provide assistance to our local task forces across Minnesota. And it would also provide ongoing support for this work on a statewide basis. As an aside, that's not in here, but it would impact this, as this unit is run out of our predatory crime section. We've experienced significant increases in the amount of child sexual abuse material that's been reported to the BCA that's run out of the same unit, going from 3,000 tips in 2019 to 7,400 last year. By funding this proposal, it would also allow us to free up resources that now provide assistance to our human trafficking teams to focus on those types of cases that's run out of one section from there. It also would be a very critical component, and one of the reasons that we've indicated to provide this funding directly into the BCA as a recommendation is we do not focus on labor trafficking right now because of the limitations on the grant. We have a very limited bandwidth that we're able to do that through the BCA resources. This would allow this task force to address both sex trafficking and labor trafficking statewide. The last two that I'll be very quick on is CLIA accreditation. Our laboratory has been accredited for many years. This is implementing best practices through examining standards that we say we're adhering to, and then we audit ourselves to those standards by showing through policy, practice, and procedure that we are adhering to the highest standards in our laboratory setting. This would do the same thing for the other parts of the BCA, both in our law enforcement functions and the rest of the BCA and our professional services, to ensure that we're adhering to those standards. And lastly, Madam Chair and members, the governor recommends creating a centralized approach to fraud unit, and this fraud unit would focus on the fraud being perpetrated against the state of Minnesota. Those instances where people take advantage of the goodwill of Minnesotans and the work that you're doing day in, day out, and commit criminal acts when they're ineligible to receive those funds in a criminal manner. This unit would focus on those types of investigations and would also create a process where all state agencies would report into a central location so that we're able to report and understand the picture of fraud across state government. And with that, concludes my presentation, Madam Chair. I'll take any questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions for the superintendent? Representative Hewitt.
Thank you.
You're busy today, Representative.
Yeah, I know, but I'm just so excited. Madam Chair, Superintendent Evans, I do have to say, and without getting too detailed, I know that your, I believe the Infusion Center has helped my district from becoming the first story in the nightly news. You have done wonders with that, and that avoided not only that, which isn't as important as you saved lives. And thank you for that, and thank you for doing this, because it really, really puts it in perspective when I don't hear about it from you. I hear about it from my school district and my chiefs and saying this worked, and it was great to hear. So thank you for that.
Representative Russell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And well, for crying out loud.
True.
I'm sorry. Just completely shut down there for just a second. You said that you have reports, their tips coming in have more than doubled since just last year even. These are not all actionable cases, are they? Or are they? And with that being said, even with that much of an increase, the actionable cases are going to increase dramatically, aren't they?
Superintendent.
Madam Chair, Representative Grossel, thank you for the question. So the number of tips have increased exponentially. Part of that's due to our online providers developing better algorithms to identify child sexual abuse material. While they're not all actionable, we take them very seriously for a variety of reasons. One, we need to determine whether or not it's actionable, and we also need to rescue any children that are being actively abused by this video or pictures that are being disseminated on the internet. And so the cases have absolutely increased. Our team is very diligent and very dedicated to this work and believe very strongly in that work to prevent the abuse of children.
Representative Russell.
And I guess for the most part, in order to get some of these cases heard, that your teams are having to seek federal prosecution in order to get any kind of punishment or justice for these victims?
Going a little far afield of the presentation, but we'll let him answer this question. Superintendent.
Madam Chair, Representative Grossel, our teams, due to being a state agency and the nature and scope of the cases, we utilize both systems. They are prosecuted both at the state level, and then we certainly work with our federal partners, in particular in those cases that I noted where there's a child being actively abused and what we consider a production of child sexual abuse material. We utilize the federal system quite often there.
Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the little bit of lateral movement there. And it just drives home my point as far as the piece of legislation I've been pushing for quite a number of years to try to stop this stuff in its tracks, these children being exploited, raped and abused for people's entertainment. So thank you.
Anybody else? All right, Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Commissioner Evans, thank you for this. Thanks for the work you guys do. Do you guys, how's hiring been for you? And do you guys think you're getting spread out too thin? Because you're being asked to go into Minneapolis, some other places, just looking to see how you guys are doing.
Madam Chair, Representative, and with my commissioner next to me, I must point out that I am the superintendent.
Colleagues were chuckling.
Excellent question in terms. We, due to the nature of our work and hiring, professional staff, the BCA is currently comprised of approximately 550 to 560 individuals. About 110 of them are sworn special agents. So we're predominantly a professional staff organization. In terms of our special agents and the type of work that they do, we've been very lucky to find very dedicated professionals that want to continue the investigative work and have been very pleased with the staffing that we've been able to see. That being said, we are spread thin, and this is exactly why the commissioner and the governor is recommending in their budget additional resources to meet the needs of our partners across Minnesota.
All right. I think that's it. Thank you to all of you for being here today and for the great work you do. Thank you. We're going to switch up the order a bit, members. We're going to move now to House File 2678, Representative Craftsville. I will move to House File 26 to lay over. Welcome, Representative Kraft. I do see that you have an A1 author's amendment. We'll move the A1 amendment. Would you please explain the A1?
A1 was a typo that was caught.
Right. Any discussion?
And it,
I'm, A1? And all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. All right, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the Public Safety Committee. I'm happy to be here. Thank you for hearing House File 2678, a bill that would provide critical funding to the fire service via the fire safety account. Fire safety account was created by the legislature in 2006 with a 0.65% surcharge on homeowners insurance premiums. This account is a vital funding source within the fire service, and yet it has been raided during tough economic times and was reduced to its current level of 0.5% in 2013. This bill would return the fire safety account surcharge to 0.65% and ensure that the Minnesota Board of Firefighter Training and Education, the State Fire Marshal's Office, and the statewide response teams, including hazardous materials, task force structural collapse teams, and the air rescue teams, are provided the resources they need to do their jobs and keep us safe. Minnesota repeatedly appears in the bottom five of states in per capita spending on the fire service. Now is the time to return it to its original funding level and show Minnesota's commitment to supporting those who protect us day in and day out. I'd like to thank the governor for proposing this in the public safety budget recommendation, as you just recently heard, and I hope this bill underlines the strong need for change. At this time, I'll turn it over to my very accomplished testifiers.
All right. I think first we have Chief Andre Sama. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the members for the opportunity to testify on the House File 2678. I'd like to thank Representative Kraft for carrying the bill and Governor Walz for proposing the important legislation in his budget recommendation. My name is Andrew Salama. I'm the fire chief for the city of Edina and here representing the Minnesota Fire Association Coalition. The MNFAC, which is comprised of the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association, the Minnesota State Fire Departments Association, the Fire Marshals Association, and the Arson Investigators. The Fire Safety Account funds critical components of the fire service, including the Minnesota Board of Fire Training and Education, statewide response teams, including HAZMAT, Minnesota Task Force teams, and the Air Rescue Team, as well as the State Fire Marshal's Office. Minnesota has a record of underfunding the fire service, and we consistently fall in the bottom five of all 50 states in per capita spending. Excuse me. By returning the surcharge to this original level, 0.65%, this bill would help to alleviate some of the disinvestment that has occurred over the last 10 years. It will give a much-needed boost to each and every fire department across the state who rely on the help for training of firefighters. Although I serve as the fire chief for Edina Fire, I am from Winnebago, Minnesota, a small town in southern Minnesota, and this bill assures that firefighters all across the state, from Winnebago to Edina to every corner of the state of Minnesota, have the same per-firefighter funding through the Minnesota Board of Fire Training and Education. The bill also supports the emergency response teams, as previously mentioned, that provides technician-level trained staff to respond to emergencies all throughout the state of Minnesota. Thank you again for hearing this bill and for considering this request. I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Next up, we have Zach Lundberg. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Public Safety Committee for considering House File 2678. My name is Zach Lundberg, and I'm a volunteer firefighter with the Isani Fire District, and here to represent the Minnesota State Fire Association Coalition, and more specifically, the Minnesota State Fire Department Association, which represents firefighters across the state, approximately or over 20,000 of us. This bill would return the fire safety account surcharge to the original level of 0.65%, a bump of just 0.15%, while the average person may not even notice this change on their premium. It is real dollars and meaningful support in terms of providing firefighters with the training, education, and other resources that they need to do their jobs. One of the major challenges facing fire departments throughout the state of Minnesota is the recruitment and retention of firefighters. Many departments, large and small, are struggling to fill their rosters to respond to our emergencies. You don't often drive by a fire station in Minnesota without seeing a help wanted sign on a building or out in the lawn advertising help wanted. Agencies like the Minnesota State Fire Department Association and our other organizations in the fire service, represented by the MNFAC Council, are here to assist local departments in helping provide resources to support these efforts. But there is still a greater need for the support, especially in our volunteer and paid on-call fire departments in the greater Minnesota. Another hurdle that members of the fire departments in the fire service face is the support of funding for training of our firefighters. Many departments in greater Minnesota struggle with inadequate local funding to provide the proper training for their staff. This bill would help support additional funding of our training for our firefighters throughout the entire state through the Minnesota State Fire Marshal's Office and the Minnesota Board of Firefighter Training and Education. Firefighters in each and every one of our districts, both in the metro and rural Minnesota, will benefit from this reinvestment in the fire service. We appreciate your consideration, and I would stand for any questions as well.
Thank you. And I don't know if the fire marshal is testifying again or if you're on standby for questions.
If you want to testify.
Sure. All right. Come back in and welcome back again. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Chair Moeller, members of the committee, again, my name is Jim Smith, and I'm the State Fire Marshal for Minnesota. I want to thank Representative Kraft for bringing this bill forward, and I want to thank my two esteemed colleagues for giving their illustration on why this funding is so very, very important. Training is extremely expensive for fire departments. There are fire departments across Minnesota who have to choose whether or not they bolster their training fund or they buy new hose for the fire truck. We have fire departments across Minnesota that are conducting bake sales, fish fries, and steak fries in hopes of gaining additional funding to buy proper PPE for their fire departments. The additional funding that we request, the 0.15%, reverting back to the 0.65%, will be going to those fire departments in an effort to bolster funds or reimbursement funds to their department and hopefully reduce those difficult decisions those communities have to make. Thank you very much, and I do stand for any questions.
Thank you, and we did not have any members of the public sign up to testify, so we'll move on to member discussion. All right, Lee Navani.
Chair Moeller, thank you. I forget what the title is, Mr. Smith.
That's good enough.
I'm as bad as you, Grassel. Can we put it into a real-world perspective? What is this increase going to be, and what would it mean for Baldwin Fire Department?
Fire Marshal Smith.
Fire Marshal Smith.
Chair Moeller, Representative Navani, there are two sides of it. To explain what this would mean to the average homeowner, this would be an increase of $1.75 per month or $21 per year. On their homeowner's insurance policy. The increase to the firefighters, right now we are about $180 per firefighter. For every $1 million increased that goes to the MBFT, it's about another $50 per firefighter across the state. So even if we do get an extra $50, just as an example, we do have a fire officer school this weekend coming up in Duluth, and the registration fee is 1.5 times of a single firefighter's reimbursement allotment for through this bill.
Lee Navani.
That's a very important and good number to have. Thank you, Fire Marshal Smith.
All right. No further discussion. Closing remarks, Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the committee's consideration of this request. Let's support our fire service.
And with that, I'll renew my motion and lay over House File 2678 as amended. Thank you all for being here today. Really appreciate it. Members, we are still moving around on the agenda. Next, we're going to hear House File 1617. It's a Chair Becker-Finn bill. We'll be laying this over, so I will move to lay over House File 1617. And Representative Becker-Finn, I do see you have an A1 amendment. Would you like to move and explain your amendment?
Yep, those would be my motions. The A1 amendments, we have two different public safety-related bills related to supporting the Grand Portage Band. And so the A1 amendment is incorporating Representative Keeler's House File 1948 regarding an appropriation related to the Coast Guard. So we just have this one bill. We're just trying to be efficient and also match what they're doing in the Senate.
Great. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. You're really getting a kick out of my voice, I can tell. Please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as amended, and I have the chairman here, and he will obviously be able to speak to it. So for folks who aren't familiar, how many of you have been to the Grand Portage area? Some, but not everybody. So Grand Portage is way the heck up there on the Canadian border, bordering Lake Superior. And, yeah, that's a technical term. You know, they really are our most remote tribal nation as far as from where we are right here in St. Paul. And so some of their needs are different and some of their challenges are different than other tribes in other parts of the state. And so really simply what this would do is provide some funding so that they could have an emergency management coordinator, obviously some unique things with a Great Lake and a Canadian border. And then with the amendment, also fund Coast Guard position. In 2022, the U.S. Coast Guard closed its station in Grand Marais, and so now that was the station that provided service to that north of Duluth area. Now the closest Coast Guard is in Duluth, which if you've driven from Duluth to Grand Portage, is kind of an extra trip all on its own. Takes even longer by boat, and so we want to make sure that folks in that northern tip of the state are just as well served by their public safety entities. And so with that, I want to make sure we have time to hear from the chairman.
All right. Welcome, Chairman, and please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Anin Bonjour, Robert Disha and Dijnikaz. I'm Robert Disha. I'm the chairman of the Grand Portage Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. I'd like to thank Representative Finn for bringing this forward. I guess one thing I want to start out with is this isn't a specific Grand Portage thing. This is the Cook County Sheriff's Department Grand Portage bill. Working together on this, it just kind of seemed a little faster to get it through with me bringing it. So anyway, in the last 3 or 4 years, well, we'll start out with, go back a little farther, the Coast Guard station closed. In the last 3 to 4 years, Grand Portage Trust Lands Department, which is our natural resource department, has been doing rescues on Lake Superior. They do 6 to 8 rescues a year, usually with a broke-down boat, kayak with a sail on it that's heading for Isle Royale. We find it 15 miles the other way. Takes us 8-9 hours to find it. Anyone here has been to Isle Royale?
No.
No.
A bucket list.
You should go. Anyway, Isle Royale is 18 miles off of Grand Portage. There's probably 600 to 700 feet of water between there and there. Todd Harbor is another 30 miles down the island. Last year, we had to go rescue a pontoon boat out there. So the people boating nowadays are getting really interesting. They're going out in 14, 16-foot boats. I go across with my dad in a 28-foot boat with dual engines just to be safe. Anyway, I could tell you lots of stories about Lake Superior, but anyway, this funding is, that was just one of the things I wanted to make clear there. This isn't something that we wanted to do. It's doing these rescues is taking away resources from our people doing their job. Their job is to work on the reservation, in our reservation boundary, in our waters. Now they're out for days picking people up, you know. With this funding, with the Sheriff's Department, we'd be getting two boats. One would be located in Grand Marais, one would be located in Grand Portage. There'd be a couple employees in each place. I think you all got a letter from the Sheriff Eliason, sent a support letter in. We had a safety event that happened last week up there, so he was unable to leave the county. Anyway, that should be pretty much it, you know. Just black and white. The boating nowadays, the smarts of it is just going away. We have 1,500 square miles of water to patrol now, so.
All right.
And if anybody watched me on Monday there, I'm not much of a talker, so.
Can't say the same for everybody.
Yeah.
All right, great. Well, we didn't have anybody from the public sign up to testify, so we can move on to member discussion. Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair, for being here. You just answered the first question I had. Cook County Sheriff's is in support of this?
Yeah, you should have a letter from him.
Okay. All right. That was just one of them. What is do you know off the top of your head just what the temperature of Lake Superior gets in the summertime?
The surface temperature in late August will get up to 54 degrees. That's when the trout start biting, and a foot down from that, it's 36 degrees.
36. Dang near freezing. Thank you, Madam Chair. Dang near freezing. So to have that, to have the loss of that Coast Guard vessel stationed there, time is of the essence when you have people who are distressed, especially on that lake. It can get awful ugly awful fast. I mean, I got Lake of the Woods in my district, and, you know, that's a lot warmer in the summertime. But you can about imagine in those cold waters, people aren't going to last very long, real short time. So I just, and you mentioned how many rescues a year?
Chairman.
As of right now, Grand Portage does 6 to 8. And with the Coast Guard station closing, I wish the sheriff was able to be here. He could give a little more what happens down the shore. Grand Marais is about 36 miles down the shore from us. So.
Thank you.
And I'll just note, I don't think we have the letter in our packet. I'm not sure what happened. So if we
we'll make sure that we... Madam Chair, we'll make sure that everyone gets it. But, I mean, this does have the blessing of the county. I mean, everybody wants folks to be safe when they're on Lake Superior and in that northern part of the state.
I would just like to...
Great. Go ahead, Chairman.
I guess one of the things I would like the Grand Portage Band and also the Cook County Sheriff's Department, I'd like to be them and have them in the position to do rescues versus recoveries. There's nothing worse than having to go out and recover a body off of the Lake Superior. So, you know, like he says, time is the essence.
Thank you. All right. Lead Nabati.
Hey, thank you, Chair Mueller. Just a couple quick questions since we don't have the letter to fill in the blanks. So is this going to be manned stations?
Yes.
Okay. And so the thank you, Chair Mueller. And so the boats will be on the water ready to go?
Yes. I believe they will actually be patrolling. You know, I think that's one of the things that we're going to see as the Coast Guard is gone now. People are going to start getting careless. They aren't going to have their life preservers, their, you know, all the stuff that you need when you do get a Coast Guard inspection and get your little sticker there. I think those things are going to kind of start going away because they know that the Coast Guard isn't around.
Chair Beckerfin, did you have
I was just going to clarify. The staffing would require 3 seasonal FTEs in each of the locations in Grand Portage and Grand Marais, and then it would be for the 7-month boating season, so sort of recognizing that it's not year-round, but, you know, the staffing costs to have people there. And I think we added up total staffing would likely cost about $250,000 per year, and then making sure that they have large enough boats that are outfitted properly to do those rescues as well.
Representative
Bonnie. Thank you, Chair Mueller. So my follow-up question is going to be, is this, are we looking at an ongoing, we have a $3 million, is this a startup fund, and then we'll have ongoing funding requests in the future?
Chair Beckerfin.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And I would expect that there may be some ongoing costs, but not at the same level, because part of this is outfitting things and making sure that they've got the correct equipment and boats. I will also say, you know, we'll be working as well. You know, it seems like the Coast Guard, you know, they pulled this back, not at the will of the people who actually live there. And, you know, we will continue to work on other mechanisms to make sure that this is funded and ultimately that those who should be responsible are responsible. But in the interim, we just want to make sure that we've got that safety in place for folks.
Representative Devani.
Thank you, Chair Molley.
All right. And any further closing comments, Chair Becker-Finn?
We'll just turn it over to the chairman. I think this is it's pretty straightforward. It's an appropriation for a very specific thing. It will benefit tribal members and everyone who lives and visits the North Shore area of Minnesota.
Great. Go ahead, Chairman.
Yeah, I think when you all get a chance to get a copy of the sheriff's letter, he does spell out the statute in there, what he is responsible for. So it does kind of back this, I think, or I went to get it. But it is definitely a need. Anyone, like I said, anyone who has been on Lake Superior between Isle Royale and Grand Portage, it's nothing to have a flat sea coming across, and within an hour the wind will switch and you'll be in a 10 to 12. So, and that's real water, that's not Lake of the Woods. So.
Well, thank you so much. And we heard that there's bad weather way up there. I can't remember what the direction is, you said, Chair.
Yeah, well, I just thank you, Chair Mueller. Just recognizing, you know, we're all stuck in these committee rooms without any windows, but there's actually, like, weather events happening. I know I had my own family member driving up north right now, so very aware of that. And the chairman obviously travels a very long way to get here to the Capitol to advocate for his people. So.
Yes, so thank you so much for being here. Safe travels on your way home. Yeah. And with that, I renew my motion and lay over House File 1617 as amended. Thank you. All right, members, our next bill is House File 1322, Representative Tabke's bill. Representative Tabke, would you like to move that House File 1322 be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation, Finance, and Policy?
I'm sorry. I love you to death, but I could not understand what you're saying. Could you say that again?
Would you like to move that House File 1322 be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation, Finance, and Policy?
It goes to Ways and Means from here.
Oh. All right. So your motion is that House File 1322 be re-referred to Ways and Means.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for that correction. And you do have the A1 amendment. Would you like to move and explain the A1 amendment?
Yes, this is a technical amendment to make some technical changes from the last amendment that we had. There's technical changes. Sorry, I was not sure what's wrong with my brain right now. But technical changes that affect 1322 and to match up as well with what's going on in the Senate.
Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. All right, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you very much, Chair Mueller. So this is House File 1322. It's the transit safety bill. So we've been working all session on handling and finding solutions from the legislature on issues that are happening on transit right now. So there are significant issues where there is rampant drug use, issues with people experiencing mental health crises and different things. And transit is a magnifier for all of the issues that are going on in society. And so folks collect on transit. And we need to make sure that from the legislative perspective, we are leading on this and that we are helping to solve the problem. So what this bill does is basically a two-step bill. The first one is an intervention program. And so we will have an intensive period of enhanced enforcement, so utilizing both social workers to help people who need help from county, from DHS, from different contractors throughout the state, and that we have $2 million allotted to that. And then the second phase is from there is to have an ongoing maintenance of that. So we hope to have gains to get transit where we want it to have so people can have a safe and comfortable ride. And then secondly, to maintain those gains that we have with additional ears and eyeballs on transit with folks called TRIP personnel, so Transit Rider Investment Program. And so those folks will be there to enhance, to enforce fare evasion and code of conduct and those types of things, as well as be a concierge type service to make sure that people know how to use the transit, get from point A to point B. And we've had in previous testimony, we've had a gentleman, young adult named Aiden, who is has Down syndrome, and he used to use the transit to get to work every day. And so he lives in Apple Valley, and he would ride the Blue Line, and unfortunately was robbed and beat up, and it was a really bad situation. And so we also have in this bill a navigator position, so using trip personnel as navigators to help people who are either have disabilities or are elderly or just afraid of using the transit but want to use transit to get back into using it as we get the system propped up and back running. And Madam Chair, I have one testifier here today to talk about transit.
Thank you. Mohammed Abdul Ahad, Executive Director. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, almost afternoon. Good morning, Chair Moore. My name is Mohammed Abdul Ahad. I'm an executive director for Touch Outreach, and that stands for Teaching Our Urban Communities Hope. That's a nonprofit organization that's grassrooted right in the city of Minneapolis. Well, I'm here today to talk to the issues that's been, if you all heard about the Metro Transit along the Lake Street corridor, Lake and Hiawatha. Me and my team of about 28 men and women, we are currently on the partnership with the city of Minneapolis, known as your violence interrupters. So we canvass that area 6 days a week, East Lake Street corridor, West corridor, and also downtown Minneapolis. So we've been providing a lot of different resources and a level of safety on the Metro Transit. So we see a lot. So I'm here to testify and give you a walk through the lens of the things that we see on a daily basis. So one of them is that we're not dealing with a group of people that's just loitering. Loitering is, you know, that was 2 decades ago. What we're seeing now is something that it's a cultural change, right? A lot of drug usage, a lot of homelessness, a lot of just, you know, people that's just hanging out with nothing else to do. So me and my team, we've been engaging with a lot of those individuals out there trying to find resources to help them, you know, get out of the state of being that they're in. But the flip side of that is we don't get a lot of funding to do those things. So we're building a lot of those resources on our own, building relationships, finding those resources out there to be able to help solve the problem, you know. But it's just not enough. We're out there 4 days a week, and right now that's on the city's dime, you know, but we're trying to do what we can with the little bit that we have. And I'm surprised a lot of people are not being a supportive, you know, this of what we're doing with these initiatives. We'll try to help as far as community, because that's where I come from, community. You know, I just wanted to share that the training that we've had is de-escalation, mediation, conflict resolution. Narcan training is one of the things that we've been using mostly lately. In the past 90 days, we responded to 28 overdoses. 28. And that's just the number that we know when we're out there. Out of the 28, we actually saved the lives of about 7 individuals that had no pulse. And what if we wasn't there? You're talking about prevention work. That's the work that we do. The preventative work is more important than just responding to it. Because a lot of times we're out there, EMTs show up, law enforcement show up, and they say, you know, they arrive on the scene 40 minutes later. We could have had a lot of dead bodies if we wasn't there. So, you know, me and my team, we call it ground zero. I hate to say that because some of the people take offense to it that hang out in that area. But it's ground zero. If you don't believe me, I suggest some of you guys come out there and just take a look and just take a visit and just see what's going on over there. I got a big team. We'll make sure that you're safe. And I wanted to say is that I don't believe having 2 security personnel will solve the problem there at that station. You know, we've been out there for 2.5 years now, and I think I've seen security maybe 2x. That's concerning to us. And that's not our job, it's not our responsibility, but as violence interrupters, because we're there to disrupt violence, patterns of violence, but we understand when we're dealing with those situations, those problems there, that is a breeding ground for violence. So guess what? That becomes our responsibility. We can't just ignore the fact that we got unhoused people out there, chemical dependents out there, and just people that just have nowhere else to go to hanging out. One of the schools we serve is South Minneapolis. I just signed a contract with South Minneapolis Public School System to do the very real work that we're doing at de-escalation, mediation, conflict resolution for our youth. Because the prevention work is more important. What about those that haven't experienced that lifestyle? They are important as well. So, you know, I just wanted to talk a little bit about just about that. You know, I just I get emotional at times, y'all, so excuse me about this work, because a lot of the work we do, it goes unnoticed. You know, it's done in the dark, and it's not done in the light. You know, that's why I encourage a lot of people to come out there and see the work that we do as Violence Interrupters, being out there 6 days a week. That's a lot of time that me and my team is dedicating and sacrificing, being out there away from our families and our loved ones, just to make sure that the people in our community are safe. So this is not just no walk in the park. Our lives are important as well. So we're taking a risk. You know, we're walking out there. We're not armed with firearms. We don't have bulletproof vests. You know, some people say I'm crazy when I say our weapons are smiles and telling people, giving people hugs and telling them we love them. You know, we approach this work with humanity and dignity. You know, we're dealing with human beings. So you have to understand human rights. Human rights, first of all, right? Approaching this work with empathy and just, you know, acknowledging a human being is in front of you, it changes a lot. And that comes with training, a lot of training. Every team member on my team is trained. I got two of them up in the crowd right now. I could have brought 28 men and women. I didn't want to do that. I didn't know if I had enough room in here today. But just so you can see the presence of my team and know that they're dedicated to this work that we're doing. But yeah, I just, you know, the public transportation, I talk about that a lot with the community that I'm in, Phillips community. And they tell us all the time they're only comfortable when we're out there to ride the trains and the public station. So I say right now, I say, you know, I have a conversation with, you know, with community, and I say what I look at and what I'm seeing is trauma, trauma, trauma. Trauma is taking over our businesses. Trauma is taking over our public transportation. Trauma is taking over some of our own homes. We can't ignore it, you guys. This is a real problem, and it's only going to get worse if we don't try to come up with a solution now as a collective. Because what bothers me is that I go one place and they say that's not our problem. It's not our jurisdiction. It's on the city. It's on Hendeman County. It's on the state. It's all of our problem, because these are all of our children. These are people from our communities that we serve. So I just wanted to share a little bit of that, you know, just coming from my standpoint of someone that's being out there 6 days a week with my team, you know, just disrupting violence and just trying to put the resources out there and find the resources that's needed, because that area right there, that corridor, is very much being underserved with resources. That's one of the busiest intersections in South Minneapolis right now. Thank God that I've partnered with neighborhood organizations that was able to provide some of those resources surrounding homeless encampment, food distribution, corporate neighborhood. I thank them a lot for being one of those resources that was available for us when we first started this work, when we had nothing.
And Executive Director, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap it up, because you're going to get kicked out of this room.
Right? Okay, sorry about that. I tell you, I get emotional. I can talk a long time about this because it's a very well-needed subject. Well, sorry about that. Sorry, Madam Moore.
Don't be sorry at all. Thank you so much for being here and for the important work you do, and to your team, too. We do appreciate it. We did not have any members of the public sign up to testify, but we can move on to member discussion now. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to look you up. I went on a ride along with MPD last Friday, and it occurs to me that it might be worthwhile to do a walk along with something like that, primarily because, and I think this is a common problem outside of the metro, I don't know how to think about what groups like that do. Violence Interrupters as a term is frankly something that gets a lot of scoffs and raised eyebrows. Because people don't understand what it is. My wife used to take the light rail from the Lake Hennepin or Lake Hiawatha station a few years ago. I can't imagine her being comfortable doing it now. And I don't know. When you see a cop walking the street, you know who they are, what they're there for, and how to engage with them. I don't think the public knows how to engage with this. And what the value is that they're getting for it. So I look forward for opportunities to learn more about that. Thanks.
possibly as we think about where the committee is going to go on our interim tour, you know, this is a possibility for us as well. Representative Tabke, did you have a comment? Okay. Further member discussion? Lead Navani.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. A couple of technical questions to clear up. Representative Tabke, so what's the current trip personnel staffing levels and what would this bill take it to?
Representative Tabke.
Thank you, Chair Mueller and Representative Navani. So currently it doesn't. There is a kind of a cobbled together program that Met Council is working on right now with a couple dozen folks that are doing this type of work, but this program currently doesn't exist, and so we would be making it right now, and the goal would be for it to be between 40 and 60 folks that are employed in this type of work across the entire transit system for buses and trains, and moving from there and learning and figuring out exactly how it works and how we can make the most impact.
Lead Nobody.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. So, Representative Tadke, so it's 40 to 60 is the goal, and maybe I missed it. How many are there now?
This program specifically, thank you, Chair Mueller and Representative Valley, this program doesn't exist right now. There's a version of the program that Met Council is running, but they don't have the ability to do administrative citations and things like that. It's folks that are there folks that are there to help with the officers and with what's going on. Now, if you'd like a specific number, Met Council is here, and they can come down and talk about that if you'd like, but we can get that to you and send it out.
Representative Abani.
Yes, that is the number I was looking for. One more technical question. Why not hire these as actual Met Transit employees as opposed to subcontracting them out?
Representative
Tucky. Thank you, Chair Mullen, Representative Abani. So this is, it's a different type of program. So this is doing work that I, in general, don't think is necessary, is completely appropriate for law enforcement to be doing all the time. So we want law enforcement to be involved in building community. We want law enforcement to be involved in prevention, but also responding to issues that come up and that kind of thing. And right now, Metro Transit Police are down about 30 uniformed cops on throughout the system. And so they have 131, I think, is what is available to be hired, and they're somewhere around 100 right now. And so these would be augmenting that type of work, and so these would not be sworn officers. These would be folks who are able to do administrative citations, which would be akin to a parking ticket type thing for folks who are on the trains without having paid fares, but also to do code enforcement, and also to help out. So they'll carry Narcan, they'll be there to assist, and so there are really successful programs like this on transit stations across the country.
Representative Navani.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Tadke, I don't think I asked if they were law enforcement. I was just asking why couldn't they be employees of Metro Transit.
Oh.
I asked this because when this bill first came, and I think it was one of the last bills I heard before the COVID shutdown, when Representative Long had a bill very similar to it, and at that time they presented a proposal for the ambassadors. And when they broke it down to the administration and how the dollars would be used, over half of the money was used for support and office personnel. Of all the money and all the personnel hired, less than half would actually be on the train. We're duplicating. We've got the Met Council infrastructure already there. Why are we not hiring these as actual employees so they have a little more direct control over them, and then they have direct control over issuing these citations? Make them employees of Metro Transit. I don't understand why we're breaking it off.
Representative
Tucky. Yeah, Chair Mueller, Representative Vatney, sorry, I did misunderstand your question. These are employees, so again, there are two phases of the program. The intervention is a current quick push to make sure that we are changing the culture of what it's like to be a transit rider. And then the second part, the ambassador, what used to be termed as the ambassador part, was my bill in 2019 and 2020 that I carried at that time. With that, those are the trip personnel, as it's called, they will be employees of Metro Transit.
Representative Nevada.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Tadke, you can see the resemblance between you and Representative Long. So. I apologize for that. You mentioned contractors before. Who would the contractors then be?
Yeah, so Representative Moeller, Chair Moeller and Representative Vanni, thank you. The contractors, so the first phase, the intervention phase, is we have an untenable position right now on our transit system. It is not as safe as we want to be. It's not a quality ride for the vast majority of people who want to be riding the train. And there's a general lawlessness that is happening on the specifically Blue Line and Green Line. And so we need to make a massive shift in how that works. And so we are working with counties. We are working with cities all along the lines. We are working with independent contractors. We're working with folks. We have $2 million in this bill to make sure that we have an enhanced presence of folks who will help people experiencing homelessness, mental health crises, drug addiction, those types of things, that we can get those people the help they need, and also to have enforcement of the rules of what it is to be a transit rider. And so that's where the contractor side comes in, is for that first 3 months after we get this passed to have an enhanced presence on the Blue Line and Green Line, and then have that be shifted over to a long-term maintenance to be where we're supposed to be. Because this, if we'd passed this, the ambassador program, as it was called then, in 2020, we would be in a dramatically different situation safety-wise on the transit system than we are today. And so this will very much help out.
All right, and we really need to wrap up here. Anything else?
Fiscal note question.
Go ahead.
The preliminary fiscal note comes in at about 50% of the cost going to the counties. Are you negotiating with the counties on this increase, and where are we at with those negotiations?
Representative Tacky.
Thank you, Chair Moeller and Representative Vanni. So I mean, you've got more information than I do because I haven't seen a fiscal note for it. So the fiscal note is still in process for this bill. And so what the bill does is it hires it funds a project lead. So it hires a project manager for within Met Council, and it funds that position. And they will do, of the $2 million that we have for the intervention program, they will do the negotiating and working with folks to pay for overtime, to pay for other things that are necessary to make sure that we get the people where we need them.
All right. We're going to move on to a vote now. That is all right, because we need to hear one more bill today. So Representative Tabke, I'm just going to skip closing comments.
Yep.
All right. Representative Tabke renews his motion that House File 1322, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Members, our last bill on the agenda is House File 41. Representative Feist, I will move to lay over House File 41. There are no amendments. She promises she'll be fast, so I'm turning it over to you.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Committee. You all heard from the BCA today, so you know who they are. I'm not going to tell you. They have a fusion. Oh, actually, I do need to tell you about the Fusion Center. So within the BCA is the Fusion Center. Its purpose is to allow participating agencies to share information about suspected criminal and terrorist activity. Through Fusion Center, stakeholders collaboratively gather information, analyze data, and share information with the goal of fighting crime and terrorism locally, regionally, and nationally. The goal of this bill is to create an annual reporting requirement for the Fusion Center to understand what type of activities are being monitored, what scale of information is being collected, what quantifiable benefit there is to this type of data collection and sharing, and to provide more clarity on the data sharing between state and federal agencies. This transparency is particularly important when it comes to government agencies gathering data on private citizens who may not have violated any laws. I worked on this bill directly with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and thank them for their collaboration.
All right, and there are no testifiers, no members of the public signed up to testify. Any questions? Comments? Can't tell if that's a no. Nope. Nope. All right. And so we don't think we need closing comments. With that, I renew my motion and lay over House File 41. That was the fastest bill ever. With that, members, we are adjourned.